Okay. So that's succeeded so far. So welcome in this May PNP community call. My name is Bert Janssen. I'm a senior consultant in Microsoft Consulting Services, and I've been working with the PNP team for
Right.
as of the beginning. There's someone. I'm gonna mute some guys here. Mute. Sorry guys, but I'm gonna mute the audience like this. Okay, better. So as said, the May community call. Typically, you would expect Vesa Juvonen to kick off this call and to walk you through the new stuff. But Vesa is on a well-deserved holidays after a busy conference weeks being at Build and Ignite with lots of other customer interactions in between. So you'll have to stick with me for the coming half hour, where I'll explain the PNP status, and then, as usual, last half hour will be filled with demos. So we have Martin Hatch on call, who created a nice JS link sample that shows you how powerful you can how things can be very powerful when you combine JavaScript with SharePoint. And Doug Burks is a Microsoft DX person, and he has been adding a few nice Outlook and Excel apps, or add-ins, I should say, as of now, which also will be shown. And if time permits, we'll also do an additional demo about the responsive design. So I think we covered that. Yep. So let's move on. Just a quick highlight, you've seen this slide many, many times, but the PNP is getting broader and broader and broader. We have OEM group, we publish to MSDN. We have Channel 9 videos, we have training material. So PNP is truly becoming a kind of a central source that feeds different initiatives at Microsoft. And you as a community member, your contributions are very valuable here because you can see your work appearing everywhere. For example, Tobias Simgren created a guidance article, and the guidance article now ended up on MSDN, which is great. So it's actually your first external contributor provided guidance article that went to MSDN. Super. Also, what I want to point out here is that the PNP repository in GitHub might be becoming a bit overwhelming. If you go to samples, you have to really scroll and find where is my sample that I need. There are about 80 or even 90 samples already, and in total we have 140 plus solutions in there. So I would like to emphasize again that going to devdoffice.com is a way to also filter down on the samples we have. Might not be perfect always, so we might still miss some recent samples, but we try to keep the devdoffice.com site up to date with the samples we have, which gives you kind of different angles to find the correct sample. Like if you want to find something about branding, you can kind of configure it like that. We had a busy conference season being built and Ignite. Now at Ignite, we actually even had a whole PNP delegation, a PNP team present. We had a booth. You see the picture on the top. Some guys might recognize themselves in the PNP booth, but unfortunately, I wasn't there. But what I've heard from the other guys is that there was a lots of people showing up in the booth, asking questions, being in the queue to be able to ask a question to the team. So actually, that all went super. There were several sessions at Ignite covering PNP topics. Vesa did a session about branding, which was a really a success, I would say, because I think the session was triple booked. So people had to. We had to actually reschedule this one again, so the day after. And even then, it was full house. So great work there. was a session about on-premise development, future-proofing by Vesa, also well reserved. Then there was our session where lots of PnP people I contributed, like me, Erwin and Frank and Vesa and Paolo is not on this list. Did you contribute, Paolo? I don't recall anymore. But yeah, that's about transforming full trust to YAP model, which is actually one of the key starting points of the whole PnP initiatives, how to help customers transform what they have in FTC today using the YAP model or just using out-of-the-box capabilities. And then Steve did a deep dive in custom app provisioning and deployment, so which also went pretty well. So I would recommend to check out these sessions, and you can always reach the guys in our Yammer group. So great work, I would say. Thanks for those great sessions. The mandatory statistics. All in all, we keep growing. The forks keep growing. Number of merge pull requests keep growing. Now, these also contain some of the pull requests also contain a pull request from our internal team. So it's not all external non-core team pull requests, but nevertheless, it's growing heavily. We are kind of slacking on the issues, so apologies for that. We've been very focused on site provisioning and on being at Ignite. And as a result, we have about 60 plus issues, or even more nowadays. Whereas we try to keep it like under 25 visible on one page and manageable. So we definitely have to catch up on issue handling and getting you guys a response on open questions. If it's just a question and not really an issue, you can also raise it on the Yammer group. I think there is my response rate and response time definitely is better in the Yammer group. The visitors kind of stay stable, so we keep hanging around 4,000 plus average unique visitors over 2 weeks. So great, with peak days of going at almost to 700 people. NuGet is growing as well. Just for information, we updated the NuGet package to include the new Microsoft Online redistributable NuGet package. So the CSOM binaries for version 16 for online are available as a NuGet package, and this NuGet package was linked to ours. So if you now download the PnP NuGet package for Office Online, for SharePoint Online, then you also automatically get the official CSOM distributables with you. Yammer has been growing as well, and again Facebook as well, so all good there. Okay, so we have several new contributions, new samples. There's a sample and about responsive CSS injection. It shows you how simple it is to via adding a custom CSS to transform your existing non-responsive site to a more responsive model. There are list rate settings, an API to be able to enable rating for a list and publishing site. So pretty nicely done. Then Martin Hatch added a JS link, which we'll demo later on today. And so we'll, but it's using the JS link hooks in the list to give different views of data and different editing options for data. A new chat room app has been added based on SignalR. A workflow template deployment, which more focuses on how to deploy workflow across site collections, has been added. Then we have the two Office add-ins that Doug created, and the ones that he will also show today. One shows how to format and bind the data in Excel, and the other one is actually a pretty cool one. Like if you get a mail from UPS with tracking information, this add-in will then inside Outlook show you the tracking data whereas your package. And finally, we have a complete provisioning end-to-end solution. So I think the Vesa created that one. Yes, that's the first end-to-end solution that uses the new provisioning engine to show how you can create this end-to-end model for your customers. As said before, we've been still very busy on provisioning. We did it last month. This month, again, we have been really focusing on provisioning. So we now support the community provisioning schema. So I think it will be on a slide later on. But there is a community managed schema that now the PnP engine fully supports. So the idea is that that schema further evolves and that the PnP provisioning engine is one of the engines that supports that schema. But other engines, other products from ISVs potentially could also start supporting the schema. So we end up with a one universal schema that can be applied everywhere. This also means that we have to support multiple versions. So Paolo did great work on being able to read a configuration file in the old format and save it back in the new format. So we have full transparency over there. We added support for pages and adding web parts to pages, both wiki pages as regular web part pages. We have support for site collection-based managed metadata. We now can provision rows of data, so you can add data row elements in your list to get it created at provisioning time. We can deal with lookup columns, even taxonomy fields, so something which wasn't that obvious in the old world. We can declaratively deal with taxonomy fields. You can set properties for files nowadays. Another nice one is a delegate. So if the engine is doing provisioning work, either fetching a template from an existing site or applying a new template to a site collection or a site, then you can hook up to an event and you can see like where is the engine, at what step is the engine busy. So you can show like a progress bar and some more feedback to your users so that they are aware of where the process is. Around on-premises, we got a loud and clear message in Ignite that lots of you are still working in on-premises and want to use the engine on-premises. Our initial focus wasn't really on testing for on-premises, so there were some glitches. Community fixed several of the glitches, which are in the May release, but we didn't yet do a full end-to-end testing for on-premises. So I think that's definitely something that we want to cover for the next release to have a better on-premises testing in there. And overall, lots of smaller enhancements and especially lots of performance improvements as well. So all good thing. So schema that I mentioned, you can find this provisioning schema in this repository. It is an open source model, means that you can create a pull request and propose your ideas, change the schema, add something, create an issue, discuss about things. The whole idea behind this is that this schema is fully community driven. Let us know what you miss. Provide us feedback. We have also a kind of a core team that's looking into this in this repository, and we have bi-weekly meetings where we discuss what comes up and how to move forward with it. So just like for the PnP, where the sharing already is really a common thing and people share a lot, same applies here. You can share your ideas for the provisioning schema. Please do so. So as said, we currently support this provisioning schema, although let's say that the support is not 100% complete, it's 95% complete. There are some specific elements which are not completely fully supported, but that's definitely a work in progress and on the radar to improve this. Let me in the meanwhile have a quick look at the chat window. Lots of questions, but I see also lots of answers, so assume everything goes fine. Another area that might not have been so familiar with everyone on the call is our guidance repository. So the guidance repository is really meant for you to write articles. Like if you would write a blog, lot of the blog posts that you would write actually are also kind of a guidance article. You explain a certain scenario, how to realize a certain thing, and you're not focused only on the technical part, but you will have a kind of an end-to-end story on the why do I do this, and then the how and pros and cons. Now, these guidance articles that we have here are really our base to feed MSDN. What you will see that many of the new MSDN articles actually have a guidance article in this repository. So if you go to MSDN and it is linked to a guidance article and you see like, actually this is not correct anymore, I want to add something, you can simply go to the repo, change the file, create a pull request, submit a pull request, and it will get to the team. We will have a look at the pull request, we will merge it, and then the MSDN folks, they pick it up and they will update the MSDN article. So then kind of the circle is closed there, which means that you can have we have kind of a continuous improvement cycle for those new future MSDN articles. And also is a chance for you to get your name visible in MSDN. Like for Tobias, his article came from here and it ended up on MSDN. And we want to keep credits for the external contributors. So if you have a community member, submit something, your name will be moved over to the MSDN, which is, I think, nice to get some additional visibility. Now, for this month, I added a list of articles here. There are some articles created by Microsoft people. Like, I think this one was from Anton's. He's not in a call, no. About how to write your JavaScript in a proper way so that it doesn't collide with SharePoint JavaScript. Then there are some articles created by the MSDN tech writers. And a bigger group of articles, recipes as we call them, are created by Todd Baginski and team, based on input from the PNP team. So the idea behind those recipes is like, okay, in on-premises, I have a remote timer job. I have timer jobs. Now, how would I do this timer job pattern in the new world, in the cloud world? Same for site columns and content types, for field types, and so on. So it kind of helps you to learn how to. If you learn the old thing, the FTC approach, then it shows you how to do a similar thing using a non-FTC approach. Yeah? Typically using C, some JavaScript, and so on. But yeah, if you have great ideas, if you have a nice blog post that you want to get out, why not just post your blog post, but also put it in here? It gives you more visibility for the content that you create. So please do so. For this release, we had a huge list of contributors. Normally, in all the previous meetings, there was one slide with the thank you. Now I had to split over two slides because it's just too many people. And I will not gonna name them one by one, but you see there's a list of people that have been contributing bigger things, smaller things. So I would say really thank you for all you guys that have been contributing. Really appreciate it. Keep doing so now. So here is the second part of our people that contributed. So I think overall it was about 20 or so external contributors this time, which is super. It's the highest ever. So great progress there. And then there's a whole lot of Microsoft people that also contribute or work behind the scenes to support PNP, which are also listed here. I forgot Vesa's last N. Little error. I hope you don't mind. Alrighty. Good. Now, you've learned something about what we have today, where we are, what we did for the Mayrlis. I already briefly touched on some of the future plans, but this gives you a bit more of the thinking we have. For the provisioning engine, it will further improve by mainly by testing, I would say. I would think we'll not be adding that many new features because it's getting fairly feature complete. There are still some areas to improve, but from a feature perspective, we're pretty good. But we definitely lack documentation. We lack a lot of documentation. Actually, we lack all documentation almost, I would say. So, room for improvement. If someone wants to help in either of those two, on-premises testing documentation, let us know. You can also submit a pull request for just documentation. It doesn't have to be a source code, so everything is possible. And then on-premises testing, like mentioned, there is a big demand from people to get more on-premises to use PnP on-premises, and we're lacking some guidance. We're lacking some quality there as well. So let's try to improve that. Core components will further evolve, adding new capabilities, new APIs. So, for example, one that we recently added is support for structural navigation, configuration, and publishing sites. So you have managed navigation, managed metadata navigation, and you have structural navigation. So the new API can then allows you to flip from the default managed navigation to structured navigation, and then configure the options like show pages, show subsites, number of pages to show, sorting order. All of that can be configured via the API. Under the hood, it's all about setting the right properties at web level, but this API makes it very easy for you. Additional samples and solutions will each month we have new solutions, new samples contributed by Qunity, contributed by Microsoft folks. So that will keep on going. One bigger one that's in the works is a more comprehensive site provisioning UI. So we hope to get that one in for the June release. Another area that we actually have a lot of IP, but we didn't have time and to get it out is transformation. So transformation IP is all the IP we have around the practical switch from FTC to the app model. For example, you need to know you have a custom web part, FTC web part that's deployed in your farm, but you have thousands of site collections with hundreds of subsites. Where is this web part deployed? How do I find that? So we have some reporting analysis tools that give you all that kind of information. The same then for fixing. Okay, I need to change from my custom master page, which I had in the old model, to out-of-the-box master, which I'm going to use in the new model. So how do I do that? So we have utilities that can help in doing the change. We have utilities that can help adding web parts on pages, copying a list create from list definitions to a CSOM-based list created using CSOM. So all series of utilities and analysis tools that's coming. I hope to get some of them in for the June release. Then we have around the article site additional. We keep on updating MSDN. So each month we get additional MSDN articles based on our guidance. So this is moving pretty well. We'll need to do more from premises, like we talked about. We're working on some enterprise scenario messaging and documentation. ALM is a long-standing topic that we need to further work on. Okay, we talked about your transformation recipes. And another one, yeah, okay. So a lot of the data, a lot of the samples that you see in PnP are actually driven from an internal JDP program. JDP stands for Joint Development Program, and it's a program where Microsoft is working with their dedicated SharePoint Online dedicated customers to help them transform FTC to the app model. And for doing so, we have a process that And that process, which is has been proven for all those dedicated customers, is we're kind of now making that one publicly available, and it will be there hopefully in June. So it's almost there, if I recall. From my knowledge, it should be almost there already. So you will get that process in MSDN. Then you can go to your customer and apply the same process as we did for our SharePoint dedicated customers. So which will be, I think, a good thing for the community. Alrighty. Yeah, feedback, 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 feedback. You know the drill. You can always reach us via Yammer, via issue list, via private email, although I would prefer using Yammer so that the whole community can benefit. But let us know what issues you have, what concerns there are, what lives. Righty, almost show time. So first half hour was me talking, and next half hour will be more interactive, lively, with super cool demos from Martin and Doug. And optionally, I will do some additional demos as well. We'll see where we end from a timing perspective. But I think the most important ones are the first two, so I would like to get them covered. So Martin and Doug, you each have, let's say, around 15 minutes to show your work, your great work. I guess Martin, can you start? So you're our
Yeah,
presenter.
no problem at all.
You can share your screen. And start demoing.
Yeah, will do. Am I coming over okay?
Yes, for me at least, yeah, it's fine.
Okay, excuse me while I load the desktop out. That'll do fine. Yeah. Just wait for the link to do the old presentation thing. So, this is a demo of some of the sample code that I initially have been writing up for a couple of years now, based on a variety of community stuff. I've had a blog series that's been in the works for far, far too long that I fully intend to finish soon. Unfortunately, having two small children seems to put the dampers on that. But I demoed a lot of this stuff at the SharePoint Evolutions conference in London, and showed it to Bissa and Jeremy Fake, and they suggested I include it in the Office PM Dev PMP sample. So here it is. So this is the actual Visual Studio solution that you'll get if you go to GitHub and download the source code. It's a no-code sandbox solution because I'm a little bit old school, and that's just how I roll. But it's been fully tested on SharePoint Online as well as on-prem for 2013. There is one caveat of things that don't quite work, which is the Google Maps seems to at the moment be breaking with minimal download strategy with SharePoint Online. It works perfectly happily with MDS on-prem, but that's just a glitch that I'm hoping to iron out at some point. For those of you who aren't familiar with JS Link and the client-side rendering, basically it allows you to take standard fields, forms, and list views within SharePoint lists and completely override and control the rendering using nothing other than JavaScript, which allows you to define some basic HTML and CSS. So some of the samples that you get as part of this download, this is a very simple color picker where I've got some code that takes a text field, re-renders it as a drop-down box allowing you to select colors, and picking a color and typing something in. I don't actually know what cornflower blue looks like, but on the display form, just got the actual color being shown in the view, and also if you go to view item, you see it in there. So just a very basic example. Some of the much more complex examples are things like Google Maps integration. So this is taking a text field and a note field, applying some custom JavaScript to completely override the rendering so you get fully interactive Google Maps. Now, the sample you actually download generates this list for you and includes this data. So you actually have the Microsoft campus that I have to admit, I've never been to the Microsoft campus, but the Bing Maps was fairly detailed. So I've basically drawn the outline through that. On the view and edit form, on the view, you get larger zoomed in versions of these maps. You can also go to edit mode that allows you to edit shapes, select points, and the edit kind contains quite a nice dialogue that allows you to move the markers around and create your own shapes and basically have fun and play havoc. Each of the points is being selectable and editable as well, so you can have a lot of fun drawing shapes on maps and making rude pictures that you rapidly remove for any client demos. This is all done purely through JS Link and through JavaScript display templates for viewing and editing. I'll kind of whiz through all the demos first, and then I'll go through the code in as much detail as I can before we lose time. So if I go to, for example, a new item, again, the display forms initially for the new form just shows you blank entries. I can go to select location, zoom in, say pick London out, pop that one in, and it automatically populates in. So that's an example of that. Project locations is one I did for lookups. Now, lookup fields is one of those that I think tends to be used for different reasons. You either have lookups that you are genuinely referring to related information in your site, which typically tends to be things like tasks to epics or projects or clients. And potentially that lookup does have relevant data that you want to go and reference, so you want it as a clickable link. In other instances, it's not. It's purely for making a slightly more manageable, maintainable metadata. Certainly when kind of SharePoint 2010 was rolling out, lookups were kind of seen as the more editable selection for content editors to be able to control consistent choices without giving them full admin rights to go and edit content types and site columns, because you could just give them edit rights to the list. Nowadays, people tend to use managed metadata. But what I've got here is a lookup list with three columns, a lookup to a regions list, and then two lookups to countries, which is a single select lookup and a multi-select lookup. But in this instance, the region is actually acting as a filter for the country and associated countries. So when I, for example, click Europe, the country drop-down automatically populates with European countries. And the associated countries is not only showing the correct filter, but I've also changed the rendering of that to checkboxes. Certainly, when it's a small result set, having the old pick from the left and show on the right tends to jar with clients. So that's just an alternative rendering of that. And it's pretty slick. It's all done through AJAX REST calls using jQuery and just native REST. So other than jQuery, there are no special plugins in play here, the exception, of course, being Google Maps. On rendering, if I select a bunch of items, give that a name, hit save. Again, I've modified the rendering of the items here. So normally for a multi-select lookup, you'd have semicolon delimited lists with clickable links. So that's been changed to a list of bullet points, and all the clickable links in this instance have been removed. And if you go to view item, you get exactly the same thing. So a nice consistent UI throughout that. The one which I have to admit, in my alacrity of trying to get this set up, I've completely forgotten about. So I'll quickly knock it up. This is the managed metadata. So there's also a sample that allows you to bind in a managed metadata field and automatically convert that to cascading dropdowns as well. So this is certainly one where kind of regions, like regions, countries, offices using lookups is kind of the old school way of doing it. And these days, everyone tends to do it using managed metadata. I'm just going to go and double check what the managed metadata override is called. So excuse me. Where is it? And it's expecting one called. That was it. Microsoft products. So I'm just going to create a new managed metadata column. And if you download the sample, you will kind of have to do this as well. I didn't want to go through, just for the purposes of this sample data, injecting managed metadata taxonomy fields specifically for the purpose of rolling out samples. So the CSV file you can use to generate the taxonomy term set that I'm using is included in the sample data, as well as the ability to go off and create your own as well. So I'm just going to bind this into one I've created earlier, which is that one. Save that. Now, initially, this isn't actually going to do anything. You've got a bog standard term set taxonomy field here with a bunch of made up, well, partly made up, but I couldn't be bothered to verify them. But it's a basic hierarchy of product data that you can use, fairly straightforward. Now, if I cancel this out and I go and say I want the new form web part JS link property to use one of the values that I'm referring to. So in this instance, I'm going to cheat sheet and go and grab this because this has already been deployed and drop that in there. Fingers crossed. There we go. So you can already see in the edit form, if you saw that briefly, that this is now rendering as a dropdown. So now I can say, right, I want desktop systems, I want Office, I want Office 2007. But it's still a managed metadata field, it's still a taxonomy field. So it's still saving the correct value. I can still filter by the same managed metadata fields that I was previously. So if I select desktop products, include descendants, it's still going and grabbing that Office 2007 field that we had previously. So how does all this work? In the sample code, and bear in mind, this should be fairly well documented in the actual Office Dev PMP sample site itself. I've written a README file that shows you screenshots of what all these are and some references, but as much as possible, I've tried to make this fully reusable. So it's not hard bound to specific fields or schemas that I'm working with. You can literally pick it up and go. The only element that I'm adding kind of carte blanche is jQuery as a separate feature. So that's literally just a usual sandbox solution custom action that just uses the script link location to drop the jQuery library into the header of every page. So by all means, if you deploy this and you've already got jQuery as part of another solution, just turn the feature off because you won't need it. Otherwise, this is a bunch of JavaScript files that are deployed to the style library. And there's kind of two sets of files that do all the crunch work. And you've got the template overrides. Now, these are effectively registering the templates. So if I go to, say, colors, this is a fairly straightforward one. There is this statement at the top here, which is effectively the templates that we're overriding. We basically say that when this JavaScript file loads, it automatically registers an object with a certain construct, and that is declaring that there are a collection of fields, in this case one field. The internal name of that field is color, and for the display view edit new form, it should use these JavaScript functions to return the correct HTML to render each of those elements. Now, there's a whole bunch of other stuff around here that I've gone in, and I have to admit, I've gone back and refactored my own code based off of recommendations from a number of people, in particular Victor Veland's blog posts around MDS support. MDS will cause merry hell with JavaScript. In particular, each page transition will delete global variables unless you've done a type register namespace. And also, you need to make sure that this JavaScript still gets fired each time you do a page transition. So in that instance, we've got a little bit of wizardry using the register module in it, which gets called by the minimal download strategy framework each time it does a page transition. So it makes sure that this code still gets called if you go out of the list and back in again. The actual code that executes each of these, and this is the same for all of these, is actually in a separate folder called generics. So if I go into the generics, there's, for example, the colors file, and each of these is named. So you've got the colors one, the Google Maps, lookups, managed metadata, all are separate takeaway files. And these, literally, the display form is a single function that literally returns the HTML it's supposed to show as a string. In essence, that's all any of the JS link methods ever do. But of course, being JavaScript, being an asynchronous scripting language, if we're injecting the HTML in a known and consistent format, then we can play around with it. So these samples are very straightforward. You look at the lookups, and it's quite a lot more complicated. So we have, in the cascading lookups, a whole load of stuff going on, including, for example, if I want to show, where was I? A single item edit form. We basically declare and spit out the HTML that we want, but we're also then pulling through all of the items from the current speed, current field schema and rendering them. The filtered ones, however, we actually go and generate the HTML, but then we call another method which does an asynchronous REST call to go and retrieve the items based on the filter that we want to select. Now, I don't have time to go through all of the sample code. There's an awful lot of it. There's probably about 5 or 6 thousand lines of JavaScript included in the whole template. The Google Maps one in particular is quite a lot of stuff. I don't want to suggest that this is all entirely best practice. I'm probably going to go and read some of the other Office Dev PMP articles myself around writing better JavaScript and making it work more seamlessly and more efficiently. But if nothing else, this should give you a fairly good way of getting started with JSLink and how all the client rendering works. Now, in terms of the lookups, it's basically generic enough that if you pass in the name of the field you want it to filter on, it will automatically take care of that for you. So in the project locations, this is a little trick I worked out where when you're binding in the name of the method, you can use the bind method to pass additional attributes. So basically, when SharePoint wants to call the new form for associated countries, it doesn't just call that method, it will then pass in this as an attribute to the method. So this allows you to create your methods that do the rendering as completely generic kind of libraries if you want. And then in the overrides, you can use the same override rendering logic over and over again, but passing in different attributes as and where you need to. Now, the final part of the sample that you'll get is a bunch of custom lists. So these are, well, they're not custom lists, but they're list instances, if you would. So all of these use the JSLink properties, which is basically just the field XML as part of the schema. You have the ability to specify, where have I put colors one? That's good, isn't it? It's not there. Oh, countries. It's not in countries. Sorry, colors. So in the field schema, for example, the color, you can see this JSLink property on the color field itself. So this is basically declaring the markup for what large JavaScript libraries, which JavaScript files you want to load, and in which order do you want to load them every time this field is displayed on screen. So if that field isn't being rendered in a view or isn't appearing on a form, then those JavaScript files don't get loaded. And you can daisy chain them. So in this case, I basically said, right, every time that field loads, I want it to first off go and load the generic color functions. And then I want it to go and load the specific JavaScript file that tells SharePoint how to override this field. And you'll see that throughout. Now, there's one gotcha around that, which is to do with managed metadata. So if you are binding your own managed metadata fields, the taxonomy field doesn't support the JSLink property. It kind of the property is there, but if you try and use it, it gets ignored because it's effectively hard-coded in the server control. So you have to find another way of putting that on the page. But you can literally drop it in through the list form webpart properties. You can drop a script editor webpart. You can attach it to a different field, such as title. You can even, if you really want, add it to the master page or use a custom action to drop it on every page, although obviously that's not terribly efficient. So that's kind of a very quick kind of 15-minute rattle through some of the samples you've got on there. It's certainly worth checking out the Dev PMP code site. There's all sorts of code to download and a whole bunch of samples you can look through.
Yeah, great work, Martin. I've added the link to the chat window. But great demo, great explanation, super work. Thanks for that. For time's sake, let's move on to the second demo. Doug, can you take over presenting and share your screen?
Yep, it should be starting sharing now. And the demo gods are not in my favor today, but hopefully I'll be able to share something. I have two samples here, and kind of my role as recent one of the many hats I wear is helping partners develop apps for Office. And so this is using the new app model, and this is kind of a departure from where a lot of the PMP stuff is today is all focused exclusively on SharePoint. And so this is really focusing more on Office and the Office 365 APIs at this point. I have two demos to show. First is, well, we'll see if we can get one of them working. I had them both working about a half an hour ago, and then I closed something, and now neither of them work. So the first is an app that I made as a sample, and it's a UPS package tracker. And so essentially what this does is it's an app for Office, and for those who aren't familiar with apps for Office, the way they work is there's a JavaScript API for Microsoft Office, and this API allows you to hook into portions of Office documents. In this case, I'll show a mail message. And essentially what happens here is when my app, when I define my app, I define a regular expression that helps me figure out if there's a UPS tracking number in the mail message. And so when my app, when Office parses the message, it automatically activates my UPS package tracker app here. You'll notice on this other message, UPS package tracker does not show up because it doesn't match regular expression. In this case, it does, and I have a really simple regular expression that says, hey, if there's a number or anything in the mail message that starts with one Z and then like 16 numbers or letters after it, I treat that as a UPS tracking number. It's probably not the not the fanciest regular expression, but it's a simple one, and it seems to work most cases. And so what happens now is, and it might fail, what happens now is when you click on this, it actually loads a web page that's hosted, that I host. It's not hosted in SharePoint. It's not hosted in Office. It's hosted, in this case, just on my machine because I'm just showing a dev environment. And what it does is it looks at the tracking numbers, and you can see that it when I open the package tracker, and of course it failed for me today. When I open the package tracker, it highlights the regular or the matching pieces of text in the message body, and then my app essentially using the JavaScript API for Office can parse out all of those matches. And display them. In this case, I just display them in a drop-down list. This is, again, it's just JavaScript, so I'm just dynamically populating a drop-down list. And then what should be happening, and I don't know why it broke all of a sudden this morning, my website where I'm hosting this app has a simple API that all it does is it takes a tracking number, and it goes out to the UPS web services. And it could be that the UPS web services aren't behaving properly. Oh, I know exactly why it's failing. Give me just 1 second. I'll get it working. My Azure storage emulator has to be running. Okay. This will start in just a second. What it does is it goes out to the UPS tracking service, and it submits a request, gets tracking data back, and one of the UPS kind of terms and conditions is that you cache the data and you don't access it too frequently. And so we can see that I was able to retrieve package tracking details. Once I've requested it once, I actually cache it into Azure Table Storage. Again, it's in the storage emulator on my machine, but it also makes it so it's a lot faster for subsequent requests. So what this looks like from a code standpoint. Oh, and by the way, this also works on Outlook Online. So if I go out to Outlook Online and reload this, hopefully it'll work. We'll try this one. Okay, so we see that this works. There's a little different behavior in Outlook Online, where it kind of highlights the individual number, and then it displays it in line. And so I, in this case, when it's Outlook Online, I don't display the drop-down list because I'm only working with an individual number. There's one problem with Outlook Online in that for some reason it only works the first time. So the second time it can't get a tracking number. For some reason the regular expression thing isn't working. And even if I go back to the first one, I can't get a valid tracking number there. But it works the first time. I think the stuff in Outlook Online is a little, I hate to say buggy, but it doesn't seem to work the way I expect it to work, and I haven't been able to find a workaround for that. So that's the first demo. The second demo I'm actually not going to show because I haven't been able to get it to work at all. But I'll show you the code for the Outlook package tracker. Essentially what you have is you have this package tracker manifest. This is an app for office manifest. And in here you'll notice that I put there's some rules, activation rules. So I say it's a message and it matches a regular expression that's 1Z and then any 16 word characters, so numbers or letters. If it matches that, then it's going to extract the values. On my website, essentially what I do is I have a page, and it's just plain HTML and JavaScript. There's nothing fancy in here. I have an HTML page that has a link to my JavaScript file that in this case I'm calling home.js. But really, home.html, home.js are just the default pages that are created when you create a new app for Office. And then I just have some very simple HTML here. And then in my JavaScript is where I start doing the heavier lifting, where I'm going to display the item details when this thing is initialized. And to do that, I've got to grab regular expression matches by name and figure out exactly what's going on, what number has been selected. And then I go out and get my tracking data for that item. And in this case, what I'm doing is I go out and you notice that I have a getJSON call here that's going out to a UPS tracking API. And again, this is just nothing too fancy. It's just a simple ASP.NET MVC. Oops. Here I have a UPS tracking controller. And then what it's doing is it's going out, it's getting an identifier. You just call it with a get request. And it creates this table storage account, or I'm sorry, table storage table, creates it if it doesn't exist, and caches the result. So anyway, and then it goes out and it gets the package tracking detail. So that's the first one. The second one, unfortunately, I haven't been able to get this one to work this morning. Again, I closed it and my Excel sample wasn't working. Essentially what this is I'm not even going to show you all this, but there's a whole bunch of JavaScript samples for how to apply what's called a table binding in Excel. I populate an Excel spreadsheet from this app with sample data, and then I do a bunch of formatting to show how to format data in an Excel spreadsheet. So if you want to apply colors and styles, you want to clear out data, you want to add more data, you want to what else do I do? It demonstrates a technique which is required for Excel Online, where if you want to apply formatting to more than 100 cells, you have to actually do them in blocks of 100 each. Because of limitations with Excel Online, you actually have to do them in a queue. I create a queue where I do this table formatting. So if you're interested in that, take a look at it. It should work for you guys. It was working for me this morning, and then I closed some things and it stopped working. But take a look at it. If you have any questions, shoot me a mail. Put an issue in GitHub. I'm still pretty new to this project, so I'll try to do what I can to help you with that. I have some other samples coming too. Pretty soon I'll put up a sample that shows how to use the Office 365 Graph API to insert a birthday list, a formatted birthday list into Word. I've got that one working, running. I just have to get that one out and ready with the documentation needed. So that's it for me. And again, if you have any questions, let me know.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Doc. Again, great work. Actually, great to see some apps for Office of Office add-ins appearing in PNP. And we definitely would like to see more of them coming up. So call to the community. If you have interesting ideas, if you have IP to share, there is lots of a blank space there, I would say. And there are many, many ideas that can be realized using Office apps. So feel free and amaze us. So you can present this next time in our June call. Now, we only have 3 minutes left. So I don't think that's sufficient to start the third demo. So I would like to open up the floor for questions. So you can type questions in the chat window, or even come unmute if you want and ask the question. In the meanwhile, I would like to really thank everyone for being so active last month. We had a super record number of contributors, great progress. So I'm really looking forward to seeing a similar good progress and contributions for the June release. So there's a question from Ralph. Anyone working on how to maintain content types? Did you talk about deployment of content types, Ralph? So for an online content type hub is the recommended approach to get your content types deployed across the site collections. Question for branding. Using JS and CSS or fixed ID or class names that will not change in the future? Very good question from Osama. I think that's something that we don't have yet today, but something that we should be looking into. Because more and more of our customizations rely on the need on JavaScript IDs of elements. So having an MSDN article describing the IDs that will stay fixed definitely will be helpful. So maybe something that I've definitely something that I will provide as feedback to engineering. Question, is there guidance on whether using no-code sandbox solutions is still recommended? So no-code sandbox solutions is still fully supported, is not deprecated. Yeah, so it still can be used. However, if you would do something new, I would not recommend to use it. So if you start from scratch, if you build something new, you can realize the same thing using the app model without sandbox solutions. So that would be the way forward. But if you have them, then yeah, sure, they're still supported. Sandbox solutions with code behind are deprecated for online, and we will remove support for those. So be aware. So Ryan's asking, is there likely to be a close alignment for CSOM with the SharePoint engineering team for 2.16 TAP and GA? Can you be more specific, Ryan? Thanks, Roddy. So, in general, Ryan, please correct me, Jeremy, or you're still on the call, I see. APIs will evolve in 2016 as well. So the new APIs that you have in online will also be available for 2016 on premises. But to be honest, I don't have the exact view on that yet. So I might be kind of slightly off there. But once we have the more details available, it definitely will be posted and made available. And okay, Jeremy is just mentioning that the information will be coming out soon. Thanks, Jeremy. Right, we're going crossing the hour. Thanks, everyone. I'm going to close the call. I'm going to stop recording. And hope to see you all in June, early June, for our June community call. Thanks. Bye bye.